Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We are working through a paper today that, I have to be honest, had a title that sent my brain to a very weird place. The lead paper is called Fringe Science Discourse.
Right. So you're thinking, UFOs, cold fusion.
Exactly. I was thinking telepathy, maybe Bigfoot. I was all set to debunk some pseudoscience.
Of course.
But then I actually looked at the source material. It's a 1981 study by Self, Padeshia, and Stobbs. And I realized we're talking about literal fringes.
Oh.
Specifically, lattice fringes in transmission electron microscopy. So we're going from the X-Files to X-rays.
Well, electrons, not X-rays, but yeah. The sentiment holds. And, even though we aren't discussing aliens, this paper is actually about a different kind of unreality.
How so?
It's about the fact that when you look at the fundamental building blocks of matter atom seeing,
yeah,
is absolutely not believing.
That's the hook that got me. I mean, we're looking at a time, the early 80s, where microscopes are getting good enough to actually resolve the spaces between planes of atoms. We're talking about measurements under 0.2 nanometers.
Which is just, it's incredibly small.
Yep.
To give you a sense of scale, a sheet of paper is, what, about 100,000 nanometers thick?
Right.
We're talking about the gaps between the atoms that make up that paper.
But the central argument here is, frankly, disturbing. The authors basically say, congratulations, you took a photo of an atom. The photo is lying to you.
That is the core tension. And the mission of this deep dive is to answer a question that sounds really simple, but is actually a nightmare for material scientists.
And what's it?
If I take a picture of a crystal lattice, does the distance between the lines on my photo actually equal the distance between the atoms in the metal?
And the spoiler alert is the answer is usually no.
Often no. And usually no, in a way that can completely mess up your entire experiment.
Okay, so let's break this down. The paper is lattice spacings from lattice fringes. Before we get into why the microscope lies, how are they even trying to measure these things?
Right.
They lay out a toolkit of three methods.
They do. And you have to keep the era in mind. This is 1981. We don't have, fancy AI image processing. We're dealing with physical film, optical benches.
The analog age of atomic physics.
Totally. So you have this micrograph, this photo of the atoms. The first tool they look at to even see if the photo is usable is the moiré fringe technique.
I think most people have seen moiré patterns, even if they don't know the name. It's that that weird wavy effect.
Oh, yeah, when you look through two screen doors at the same time.
Exactly. Or when someone wears a tightly striped shirt on a Zoom call and it starts shimmering.
That's the one. The principle in the microsort is similar. You take your micrograph, your picture of the atomic lattice, and you physically overlay a ruled grating.
So like a transparent sheet with a perfect grid printed on it.
Correct. You're superimposing a perfect ruler on top of your maybe not so perfect image.
Okay.
And when the lines of your atomic image clash with the lines of that master grid, you get these new, much larger interference bands, the moiré fringes.
And the cool thing is that this acts like a magnifier for any errors, right?
It does. It turns a tiny, invisible error into a huge, visible curve. If your atomic planes are bent, even a tiny bit, the moiré pattern shifts dramatically.
It's like a vibe check for the crystal.
That's a great way to put it. They show this really clearly with figure one in the paper. They're looking at aluminium. To the naked eye, the atomic lines looked laser straight. Perfect.
But under the moiré grid,
they were curved, distorted. The pattern revealed that the focus had shifted, or maybe the sample thickness changed. The eye was fooled, but the interference pattern wasn't.
So moiré is good for a qualitative check like, is my sample weird? But the paper seemed kind of dismissive of it for getting hard numbers.
Well, it's a statistics problem. You just don't get enough of those moiré fringes to count them reliably. Maybe two or three big bands across the whole image. It's a diagnostic, not a ruler.
Okay, which brings us to technique number two. And this one sounds like pure drudgery, microdensitometry.
It is a bit of a tongue twister. And yeah, it was a very labor-intensive process. You're basically taking your film negative and putting it in a machine that scans it line by line.
So instead of a person squinting at the lines, a machine is counting the peaks in brightness.
Yes. It converts your image into a graph of peaks and valleys. And if you just measure the distance between those peaks, you get your lattice spacing.
The paper claims this can get you an accuracy of 0.01%. I mean, for 1981, that sounds incredibly precise.
It is, but that precision is fragile. The authors point out a huge headache. alignment. If your scan line isn't perfectly perpendicular to the fringes.
Oh, right. You're measuring the diagonal, the hypotenuse, not the actual width.
You're walking diagonally across the street instead of straight across. You get a systematic error. You'll think the atoms are further apart than they really are.
But that implies you have a perfect sample to begin with.
And that's the catch. It works great on perfect crystals. Real materials are messy. They have defects, dislocations. The machine gets confused. So it's slow, tedious, and it hates imperfection.
So if Moiré is too vague and this densitometry thing is too fussy, what's option three?
Option three is, in my opinion, the most elegant. It's called optical transformation.
This one has lasers, so I'm already on board.
It's a very clever bit of physics. You take your micrograph, turn it into a transparent slide, and you put it on an optical bench. Then you shine a laser right through it.
And because the slide has a pattern on it, the atoms, it acts like a diffraction grating.
Precisely. The light scatters, it splits into spots on a screen behind it. And the distance between those spots is mathematically related to the distance between the lines on the slide.
It's reciprocal, isn't it? The closer the lines on the slide, the further apart the spots on the wall.
Spot on. It's a Fourier transform happening in real time, just using light.
So why is that better than just counting?
Averaging. That laser beam covers a huge patch of the image, maybe thousands of atomic planes. The diffraction pattern gives you the average spacing of that whole area instantly.
So if there's a scratch or a weird kink in the lattice, the laser just kind of glosses over it?
It ignores the local noise and gives you the global truth. It's robust, but, and there's always a but.
There always is.
You lose the local detail. You lose the spread. If one corner of your sample is compressed and another is stretched, the laser just gives you the number in the middle. You lose all that nuance.
Okay, so we have our toolkit. We can check for distortion with Moiré, count peaks with densitometry, or average everything with lasers. If we do all that, surely we know where the atoms are.
You would think so, but this is where the paper just pulls the rug out from under us. Section 2 is basically about why measuring accuracy is not the same as interpretation accuracy.
That's a distinction I think we miss a lot today, too. Just because I can measure something to 10 decimal places doesn't mean I'm measuring the right thing.
Exactly. They show this with this really frustrating experiment on a high-purity iron-chromium-nickel alloy. They used the high-precision counter, the densitometer, and they just started counting more and more fringes.
Standard statistics, right. Your sample size goes up, your error bar should go down.
But they didn't. The uncertainty stayed stubbornly high. The spread in the data just... it wouldn't shrink, no matter how many lines they counted.
What was going on? What was messing with the number?
The microscope itself. The authors introduced the villain of the piece, the objective lens transfer function.
Okay, that sounds like some serious technobabble, but I know it's critical. Break it down for us.
It's not as bad as it sounds. Think of it this way. Electrons move through the sample as waves. When those waves hit the magnetic lens of the microscope, the lens shifts their phase.
Ray shifting, you mean the peaks and valleys of the wave get moved around relative to each other?
Yes. And the image you see is just the interference pattern from those shifted waves recombining. But here's the scary part. How much they shift depends on the defocus.
Defocus. You mean just being slightly out of focus?
Exactly.
Usually if my camera's out of focus, things just get blurry. They don't change size.
In a normal camera, yes. But in a transmission electron microscope, because of these phase shifts, features can actually appear to move. The paper cites a calculation showing that at a specific defocus around minus 190 nanometers, the fringe spacing on your photo can appear 1% smaller than it is in reality.
1% doesn't sound like a lot to a layperson.
In the atomic world, 1% is a canyon. It's the difference between two different materials. If you're building a jet engine and your alloy's lattice is off by 1%, all your stress calculations are garbage, your metal might snap.
And this isn't a measurement error. It's the lens itself physically moving the image of the lines closer together on the film.
Correct. The image is a simulation of reality processed by this transfer function. And it gets worse.
Gosh, it does.
The thickness of your sample also shifts the fringes. If your metal foil is a few nanometers thicker over here than over there, the electrons scatter differently and the lines might shift again.
So a single photograph is, it's basically an unreliable narrator.
That is the perfect term for it. A single micrograph is an unreliable narrator. You cannot trust it.
So how do we find the truth? Do we just give up?
No, you just have to work harder. The authors propose what's called the throw focal series.
Which is what it sounds like.
Pretty much. Yeah. You don't take one picture. You take 5, 10, 20 pictures of the exact same spot. And for each one, you just tweak the focus knob a tiny bit.
You're kind of building a data set.
You are. By analyzing how the fringes shift and change across that whole series of focus levels, you can reverse engineer the lens's distortions. You can back calculate the true spacing.
That sounds incredibly time-consuming.
It is. But it's the only way to be sure you aren't being fooled by the optics.
So the paper doesn't just leave this as a theory. They actually apply it to a real mystery. This is the tale of two steels in section 4.
This is where the rubber meets the road, or I guess the carbon meets the iron.
So set the scene for us. Why were they going to all this trouble?
They were studying something called the bainite transformation. It's a critical phase change in steel. You heat the alloy way up to about 1100 Celsius.
A process called austenitization.
Right, so the crystal structure relaxes. Then you cool it down to around 350 degrees. At that temperature, a new crystal structure, bainitic ferrite, starts to form.
And here's the chemistry problem, right? Ferrite hates carbon.
It has no room for it. So as the ferrite grows, it literally ejects the carbon atoms.
Like a crowded room pushing people out the door.
Into the hallway. And the hallway here is the remaining pockets of the old phase, the austenite. The austenite acts like a sponge, soaking up all that rejected carbon.
And since carbon atoms take up space, when they cram into the austenite, they expand its lattice.
Exactly. So the mission was simple. Measure how much the austenite lattice expanded. If you know that, you know exactly how much carbon is trapped inside.
And this matters because that trapped carbon determines how tough the final steel is.
Right. It could be the difference between a car chassis that bends in a crash and one that shatters.
So they had two alloys they were looking at. Alloy 1 with manganese and alloy 2 with nickel.
And alloy 1 was fine. It behaved itself. Alloy 2 was the problem child.
Why was the nickel alloy so much harder to work with?
It was just a mess. The paper describes it as having a massive defect density. The crystal wasn't a nice clean grid. It was twisted, broken, full of dislocations.
So that elegant laser trick, the optical transform, that didn't work.
It failed completely.
Yeah.
The defects scattered the laser so badly they couldn't get a clear reading. The average was just noise.
And the moiré patterns.
Too distorted to even read.
So they were forced to use the really tedious method, the through-focal series.
They had to hunt for tiny, isolated islands of clear crystal, maybe just a few nanometers wide, and perform that whole focus-stepping procedure on each one manually.
And what they found, it basically overturned the conventional wisdom at the time.
Right. The assumption was that the carbon would sort of diffuse out evenly, like a drop of dye in water. But their measurements proved the carbon was inhomogeneous.
It was clumpy.
Extremely clumpy. One pocket of austenite over here was packed with carbon, and another pocket, just a few nanometers away, had much, much less.
Which means the chemical composition of the steel varies on a microscopic scale.
And so do its mechanical properties. The perfect crystal model just doesn't work for real engineering materials. They proved that the messiness, the defects, actually trap the carbon and stop it from spreading out.
Wow. And if they had just used the laser, the averaging technique, they would have missed that completely.
They would have missed the entire story.
Mm.
They would have reported an average carbon content that didn't actually exist anywhere in the sample. They would have smoothed over the reality.
It really drives home the point of the whole paper, doesn't it? Methodology isn't just a box you check. It is the result.
That's the takeaway. We prefer the laser because it's elegant and gives a clean number.
Mm-hmm.
But the messy, tedious manual measurement was the one that told the truth.
So let's wrap this up. For the listener who probably isn't operating a transmission electron microscope in their garage, what are the big lessons here?
I think the first one is just a deep skepticism of the single image.
Mm.
You have a high resolution picture. That doesn't mean you have the truth. That 0.01% measurement accuracy was meaningless without knowing the focus.
Right. Context is king. Without the metadata of what was the focus, the photo is just pretty art.
The second is the danger of averaging. The optical transform, the laser, showed that averaging can hide the spread. And in the case of that nickel steel, the spread, the clumpiness was the most important discovery.
The interesting stuff is so often in the outliers, not the average.
And finally, just this idea of the transfer function. Every instrument, a microscope, a telescope, even the algorithm that feeds you news, has one. It processes the data before you ever see it. You have to understand your tool to understand your data.
That leads me to a final thought I want to leave everyone with. You mentioned how the lens can shift an atom's apparent position by 1% just based on focus.
It's a sobering fact.
In a world where we are all consuming processed images, AI-enhanced photos on our phones, data visualizations in the media, we're all looking through a transfer function. We're almost never looking at raw data.
That's very true. We're looking at interpretations.
So the question is, what's the through focal series for our daily lives? How do we change our own focus to try and find the truth instead of just trusting the first snapshot we see?
That is a very big question. You have to look at the same problem from multiple angles before you can start to believe what you're seeing.
And one will leave you all to mull over. A huge thank you for this tour of the atomic lattice. And thank you for guiding us through the physics.
My pleasure.
Keep checking your focus, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.